and I think you are a pile of shit, and I didn't think they piled shit that high. Another of the Army psychiatrists who had examined Jeffrey McDonald at Walter Reed in 1970 testified. "We began rather innocuously," he said. "I took a little past history, a general history of his childhood. He talked about his slipped disc and how it happened. There were 4 minutes to go in a varsity game, and the coach was keeping all the seniors in. Even though he had all this profound pain, he continued. I don't know whether they won the game or not. Then he talked about running the athletic program for the fraternity he was in at Northwestern Medical School. I asked him what he did for fun as a child, and he talked about reading. He said he read more than most other kids. He read everything. He read all the Lassie books. Later, he liked to read history. He enjoyed reading to his own children. He now reads mystery books. And he said he deliberately will not try to figure out the end. He doesn't try to outguess Sherlock Holmes, he said. He's read all of James Bond, Mickey Spillane, John D. MacDonald. He said he liked his jump training at Benning. He liked challenges. It's like, are you man enough? He said. He lived through it, therefore he stood up to the challenge. The people around him liked his attitude, and that was important to him. His decision to go into paratroopers was because they were hardcore. He talked about calling his wife to tell her he had decided to go into special forces. She knows how I respond to these guys. Out of 430 docs at Fort Sam, only two signed up for special forces. I'm kind of proud of you, he says, his wife told him. The fact that you take the hardest thing to do and you do it well. He talked about enjoying his work, working with dedicated, real soldiers. He was interested in what really motivated those guys. It was exciting. It was patriotic, not second rate. Then I tried to go backwards, the psychiatrist said, into various, what I thought were neutral, not charged areas. I asked about his growing up, and he talked to me about his dog, a collie named Lady, that had been poisoned. The way I conduct an interview is to try not to ask questions. I try to sit back and let the person talk. Then I try to go with the person wherever he moves to, because not only is the question important, but what he says and how he says it and what areas he moves to after are important. And he talked to me about his dog and his dog being poisoned by a neighbor lady and about his going away. He rode a bike 5 miles to a park, and he sat there all day. And he felt the police had let him down because, I think, he asked them to perform an autopsy on the dog, and they said they couldn't do that. And from there he moved, by his own volition, to talking about a pony that he had purchased for his children and his wife, and how he stabled the pony in a barn, and that he would go with the children to feed the pony and care for it. He was talking rather glibly at that point. He said initially Colette didn't want to have the pony, but that she now went out with them and would be with the children and the horse. And at that point, quite unexpectedly, his mood changed very dramatically. He started to cry, and I said, "What are you crying about?" And he said he was crying about his family, and he really became quite upset, crying quite heavily. And he began to say that it's not right, that it shouldn't have happened, that he never did anything wrong, and it's just not right. It was very striking, the amount of feeling that was being expressed here. He said that he had taken care of some of the crummiest people in the world, and how could such a thing happen? How could this possibly happen? Then he started talking about how wonderful his wife was, that she was one of the kindest persons he had ever known, and that he still wakes up and expects her and the children to be there, and that he has to fight constantly to be cool and competent, and that he has a tremendous feeling of guilt about not being competent, not being able to handle the situation. Then he goes into tears again. I asked at this point about how he thought all this would come out. He said, "These proceedings? I'll get out of these proceedings. I've got the most competent lawyer in the world, and he's got the best of all possible worlds, an innocent client. And then he went on and became quite angry and began a long tirade about the incompetency of the army investigators, which to me, I didn't know anything about what was going on. In fact, I had started by telling him I didn't want to hear about it, so they might have been incompetent for all I knew. But he went into detail, saying, you know, first of all, they didn't respond, and then when they did respond, they came in and destroyed the crime scene, and then they absolutely refused to go out and look for the people that did it. The FBI just ran away from the case, a whole list of tirades. He was really angry at the Army for their misconduct. And then he starts talking about them, charging him, that, you know, it's a big thing at Fort Bragg. There are two camps, the doc did it, or the doc didn't do it. Those were his words. And he was saying that they didn't understand why he was lying on the couch. And he went into details about his being on the couch, and those kinds of things, which I didn't have any knowledge of, and frankly, it didn't make a lot of sense to me. So I asked him, would he like to have some time to get himself back together? And he took that time, and he composed himself. After that, he began talking about his feelings about the family, and he began telling me of the dreams he'd been having, dreaming of waking up and hearing the children screaming, and he can still see his wife lying on the floor. But then he tells me that his dreams have changed, his anxiety dreams. Now he has anxiety dreams about Colonel Rock, the guy that's doing the investigation. He dreams of Colonel Rock looking at him and saying, "Did you do it?" And he's saying no, but having this feeling that Colonel Rock couldn't hear him, and he's having to tell Colonel Rock over and over and over again, louder and louder. Then he began telling me again about hearing the screams in his dreams. And in spite of my letting him compose himself, he's crying again. Then he says he now has nice dreams about his family, about riding the horse, about seeing Colette ride the horse. She was like a big kid. She loved surprises. Then he says he doesn't want to share those dreams, doesn't want to talk to people about them. He thinks all this, people asking him about him and his wife, is really an invasion of his relationship with her. He thinks people are being kind of morbid in asking him about it again and again. And actually, I hadn't asked him about this at all. Well, I was taping this interview, and at that point, the reel ran out, and I had to turn it over, and he began to compose himself more. He really did begin to get himself together. He said, "It's okay for women to cry, but men shouldn't cry," which is a fantasy that most Green Beret people have. Then he began to talk about his sexual history, that his first sexual experience was somewhat alarming to him, and, oh yes, as a teenager, he once had two girls offer to have sex with him at the same time, and it really repulsed him. He said it wouldn't repulse him now. In fact, he described having one-night affairs with two women. I asked him about his immediate sexual life, and he told me that some woman had offered to come and have relations with him, and he had refused because he didn't think that would be quite right, given the circumstances. Then he talked about as a child either wetting the bed or masturbating and having wet dreams and hiding the sheets. He can remember doing that, hiding the sheets from his mother. I asked him specifically, had he ever been impotent, and he said yes, he had at one time, with a girl who was very attractive but very pushy. And he was concerned about that. Then he said, well, this could have been because he had been drinking some cold duck and he was too drunk to have relations. Then he talked to me about his sexual relations with his wife, having relations three or four times a week. He immediately says that he was never impotent with his wife, and that he and Colette were always able to have relations, but that at the time of her death, their sex life was not all that great. She was 5 months pregnant, and that bothered him. He didn't have much interest in sex with her. I asked him if his wife knew about his extramarital affairs, and he said no. And that's not important. Then he qualified that and said maybe she did know about the airline stewardess down in Texas, but They never talked about it. Then I went back and began in terms of homosexual experiences, and I'm sure the question I asked was the standard question, "Have you ever had any homosexual experiences?" He said he never had. He talked about his experiences with homosexuals on Fire Island while he was driving a taxi. He said he made extra money by fixing up homosexuals with other homosexuals. He kind of did whatever people would pay him to do. He said that sometimes the homosexuals would travel with a female companion, and he said after he fixed the guys up with other homosexual friends, he would take their girls out. There was a phrase he used, $200 plus playmates. I think he was describing what his compensation would be for a weekend's work. "Did you come to an assessment of your own?" Victor Warheide asked the psychiatrist, "as to his character and personality and what kind of man he is?" "Yes. I see Dr. McDonald as an individual who is striving constantly to be a superman. He's very bright and he's very, very talented. But he's constantly striving to be the best, to be a superman, to be a He-Man, and going in the Green Berets and all of this business. Underneath that, in my opinion, is very definitely a defense against latent homosexual desires." By homosexual desires, I don't mean he's a practicing homosexual, far from it, but that he has that drive to be a homosexual, which he doesn't act on. He's not a homosexual, but he has homosexual desires and also certain psychopathic tendencies, that is, telling me about his extramarital affairs. Again, almost being too much of a man. He is not a man without defect, which is essentially what his own psychiatrist was telling Colonel Rock. You know, here's a guy who couldn't possibly do this. What we were saying, and what we continue to say, is whether or not he did it is not up to us. But we disagree very vehemently with his own psychiatrist's conclusions that he could not possibly have done it. "Would you think," a grand juror asked, "that a questioning or challenging of his manliness would pose a threat of setting him off?" Challenging his manliness, in the sense of Colette maybe not liking too much his having become turned off sexually as her pregnancy began to show itself, and accusing him of, you know, not having it as a male, and that's why he doesn't want to sleep with her. Yes. This guy's a Green Beret tiger in black boots, and I think that would be quite a challenge. "An area where he would be particularly sensitive?" Victor Warheide asked. "Yes, sir. That's my opinion." And if some remark were made along this line, "You're not a man. Let the kid sleep here and you sleep on the sofa," or something like that, that might be sufficient under conditions of stress, such as fatigue? Right. The fatigue coming from not only the strain of being 24 hours on duty at a hospital, coming back home at 6 o'clock in the morning, spending a full day working and playing basketball, all of these things put together. Here is a man who should be tired, ready to go to bed at 11 o'clock when his wife goes to bed. But he's up. He's up until 2 o'clock in the morning reading a Mickey Spillane mystery. It's puzzling. I can't, as a professional, do any more with it than you can. But doesn't it indicate some stress? Some strain? Warheide asked. Sure. And this fatigue and stress, stemming from such conditions, making a man particularly subject, that I can testify to. Yes. What stress does is it exaggerates those sort of basic personality qualities that we have. When you're exhausted is when those things that you perhaps don't like about yourself or that you wish were different, and that you're normally able to maintain control over. Under stress, that's when those things come out. There was only one other question, this one from a grand juror. "At any time during McDonald's talking to you, when he was talking about Colette's kindness and gentleness, did he ever say to you that he loved her?" "No. He never said that. That word was not mentioned. That word was not used." I thought that was remarkable, too. Jeffrey McDonald's sister testified. She was asked first about seeing her brother in the hospital after the murders, I walked in and he was alone in the room. He was laying, looking out the window, and as I walked in he turned and he said, "Oh," and I saw him, and we both started to cry. I went over and started stroking his forehead, and we both just started saying, "Fuck, fuck, fuck," and I came out with some insane statement like, "Well, at least the time you had was good." Then other people came in the room. All sorts of peripheral people were arriving, and we would go out into the hall and start making jokes about something. We'd start laughing and crying. I think everyone was hysterical, but instead of crying we were, like, laughing hysterically, or I was. "Did you talk at all about what happened?" Victor Warheide asked. "No." "He told you nothing about it?" Someone had the TV on in the room, and what would happen is we'd go in and someone would turn the TV on, and there'd be maybe 8 people in the room staring at the TV, and nobody was talking directly about what had happened. The only facts: my mother never discussed it. Jeff never discussed it. Freddie never told me anything. I just know what I got from the paper. I would read a paper, and I'd find out what had happened. All right. Now, since then, it's been more than 4 years. Has he ever told you anything about it specifically in the intervening years? No. The only thing I would do is, I would point out to him that his personality is the type that elicits anger from other people, and that he should be careful, hoping by what I said to him, I would get the message through, so he would open up and tell me. Because I wanted to know where this much hatred came from, this much energy to destroy, if he was aware that he created a lot of anger in a lot of people. But he didn't think that. And he never opened up? No. And told you the story? No. Warheide then asked about Colette. I think she liked her life. I think she liked, you know, having a man and having a baby and having a closeness, having a unit. I was involved in how many cool guys had asked me out and, you know, that type of thing. A different world. So we really didn't communicate too much. She seemed to feel comfortable being a woman. She was a very sophisticated and a nice person. She wasn't any dum-dum. She was a fully developed human being. She was a very strong person. I admired her. I sort of modeled myself from her. They didn't have a lot of money, and they didn't have a lot of time together because Jeff worked hard. But she always seemed to accept that and say it's okay because he's working toward something good. She didn't seem to need instant gratification. She said, "When Jeff's through his internship and his residency, we'll have everything. We'll have time together and we'll have money. We'll have everything at 35 that most people don't get in a lifetime." Tell us about Jeff now. I think he puts up a big front, you know, a big show of being confident and the great rescuer. But I think inside he's a feeling, sensitive person. I have never seen him be cruel. I've heard him be critical, but I've never heard him be cruel. I've seen him selfish in the ability to, like, go to Princeton, which was using quite a lot of money, say, from our family, and that made me feel like I would feel guilty if I had to do that. But he said, "No, I'm working hard, and I will become a wage earner, and I certainly will help Mom and Dad out then. So I don't feel guilty about it." But as far as selfishness when it came to harming someone or degrading someone, when I say degrading, he would give information to someone that I would say the person could be degraded by. But from his point of view, it was realistic information. Like, you can't eat 10 donuts and expect to lose weight, and that was a fact. I would get insulted, but it was a fact. But he would never say to me, "You little fat thing." And he didn't push people out of the way. And he never, if you needed help, you needed to talk, he was never, say, too busy to listen. He'd listen, and he'd usually find a good answer. I felt that he was very adult. I think that he and Colette were very adult with each other. In the setup of marriage with a guy like that, it would be very easy for a woman to become little bunny doe, and Colette wasn't bunny doe. She was very adult. She was a very three-dimensional person, an extremely well-adjusted person, and very sensitive, a very deep person. When someone spoke to her, she didn't just hear what they said. She understood that they were coming from their life experience and who they were. She had a very good way to really understand what somebody was asking. And so it was very good, she with Jeff, because he would be sort of come out with something, an immediate statement or something, and she would say, "Now, Jeff," and she'd, you know, usually push for more clarification. It was very nice because it was helpful. They supported each other. Their temperaments, they were an ideal, well, not ideal. Well, they were adults. They were grown-ups. They weren't like two little lost kids in the world. They knew what their responsibilities were. They had a child. They had educational requirements to meet. They did it, and they didn't complain about it. They didn't act like martyrs. They really enjoyed, if they were, say, struggling as students at Princeton, they were very quick to point out that they also had Cosmo Iacovazzi or whatever having dinner with them, or that they would attend a very good concert, or they would be with Bill Bradley on the weekend. They would point out, "No, it's really okay. This is really okay with us. We're enjoying it." And in Chicago, she would point out to me that this living was temporary and that it was not, you know, money wasn't important at this particular stage of her life or in Jeff's life. And the fact that he did compete, she said it was good because then when he came home, he had things to share with her. He wasn't a husband who was just sitting at home watching TV, drinking beer. In your conversations with Colette, did she ever indicate that there were any little, let's say, irritants in the relationship? Yes, there was one. My brother felt that people who smoked were not using their heads. Every time he came home from a party, even if it was raining, he hung his suit outside to get the smell of smoke out. It seemed funny to see them hanging out on the clothesline, and Colette thought it was very funny because she and I used to sneak smokes in the bathroom or something and blow it out the window. But that was just something funny, very childlike. It wasn't, you know, it was just something amusing. The only other thing that got him upset was the way that people ate. Sloppy eaters. He always thought that was repulsive. That was the only time I can remember seeing him being a very heavy-type parent person. He was very judgmental when somebody ate sloppily. Did you know Penny Wells? I never had much contact with Penny because I thought, compared to Colette, she was a ding-dong. Was there any, let's say, rivalry between Colette and Penny Wells as far as Jeff was concerned? I don't think so, because I think Colette's opinion of Penny was comparable to mine, that she wasn't a serious contender for anything except maybe Playgirl of the Year. After February 17th, did the thought ever enter your mind that Jeff might have killed Colette? No. When I found out that someone else had a suspicion, I was shocked. I was really shocked. But then I began to process it and think, well, is it possible? For my own sanity, I had to know. I had to check out that possibility. And I thought about it, and the only conclusion I could come to was that you'd have to be crazy to stab someone 37 times, and he wasn't crazy. I don't think there was anything in his nature that could justify destroying people like that. Do you think he's capable of an act of violence? Well, the CID asked me that, and I said, he's going to Vietnam, and if you're going to Vietnam, you have to accept the consequence that you could kill somebody. So in that sense, yes, because he was a Green Beret. But when you say violence, like, you know, he wasn't the type of person who had angry outbursts. When he went into the service, why did he opt for special forces? Well, because of the adventure, and to be the greatest, you know, to be the best. It was like when my brother Jay went, my father said, if you're going to do it, be the best, be a Marine. So Jay became a Marine, and then realized that he wasn't exactly Marine on the inside. But you know, it was stressed to be the best. It was stressed to achieve. And there was a stress within yourself, you know, you'd feel better, that you were half dead if you didn't achieve. Do you remember seeing him on the Dick Cavett show? Yes. He called up and said, make sure to watch and to call some people in the area and tell them to watch because he was going to be on. and I watched, and personally, I don't agree with mass presentations of something. I don't like people who talk about tragedy in front of millions of viewers. I don't agree with that. But I also knew at that time that he was not a person that everyone would love to invite to a cocktail party, because people didn't know. I mean, his case was dropped because of insufficient evidence, which was saying that this guy might have killed his family. And he's walking around the streets of New York as the guy who might have killed his family. And while I felt that it was inappropriate in regards to the feelings, you know, the horrible tragedy, the fact was that there was so much anger, too. There was so much helplessness. What could we do? How were we going to get some action? How were we going to get people to actually follow leads? So when I talked to him afterwards about it, he said it was important that he do it, so people who didn't know could hear it from his side. They could hear from his point of view that he was okay. He was a person. He wasn't a monster. He felt this was a way to get rid of this leprosy he was walking around with, people not knowing whether to shake his hand or to walk away. Do you remember him saying anything about conducting an investigation on his own? I wanted to get private investigators, and he said we'd get milked dry. He said the FBI were the best investigators in the world. Why should we hire some rinky-dink private eye when the FBI had all the information? Did he tell you about how he and some of his friends were conducting their own investigation of the bars and hippie hangouts in Fayetteville? I just remember, no, I wasn't, like, recording things in a very systematic way. There was something about a girl that had a candle and went into a bar in downtown Fayetteville with three guys and said, "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs." But I just felt it would be kind of crass on my part, you know, to ask him about things like that. And he never told you he had found one of the intruders. We haven't discussed anything since that period. Jeffrey McDonald's sister was then asked if there was any additional information she had that she thought might be helpful to the grand jury. "The only thing I have," she said, "is an opinion. And my opinion is that he's not capable of that type of violence. He's a healer. He chose to heal, and he is very aware of pain and the fact that people do live in pain. His intention in living is to help, to heal, and I don't think he lets his ego get in the way too often. I think when his ego, say, would get in the way, it would be like in sports or something. To me, anything competitive is a form of violence. So if you want me to say there's violence, maybe competition. But as far as being a striker, or a person who had to go out and punch the world, you know, have this hatred, I really can't see it. I just think there are a lot of victims involved here. There were three lovely people who were victims, and I feel that my brother, my mother, and Mildred and Freddie Kassab are victims. And then there are peripheral victims like Jay and myself, people who really can't get about living until this thing is worked out. I think the thing, you know, everyone wants it solved. And maybe we can't accept the fact that we can't solve it. I think my brother has been like a puppet on a chain at the whim of, you know, a new investigation. I think Freddie Kassab is a very nice, feeling human being. I just think he has dedicated his life to a bad dream. People who dwell on an incident that happened 4 years ago and devote their lives to it, that is bizarre to me. And I get angry because I wonder, are other avenues being explored? You know, I don't know what the overall thing is. I think my brother's sane. I think he's normal. And I think these acts were performed by people who were not normal. I think he and Colette had a very healthy relationship. I think that he was a very sensitive and gentle man. And I think that one of the reasons this case has gone on so long is because he is so gentle and so reasonable. I think if he had had more unreasonable reactions at the time, it would have pleased people who like carnivals. At the time this happened, the chaplain came down the hall, and we were laughing. We were telling jokes, absurd, horrendous jokes. And the chaplain said, "Well, you people don't need any help. You're obviously taken care of. You're obviously okay." And then he'd go in and talk to the Kassabs, who were sobbing, you know, and in dark glasses and stuff. Well, I mean, there are lots of ways of handling something that nobody can handle. And unfortunately, we all have the attitude that we're not going to cave in. We're not going to say, you know, help. Because we knew there was nobody who could help. The only thing we wanted was to see my brother live. I wish he had been more selfish. Because I think a lot of his pain would have been avoided if he just let himself be a burden, say, to my mother, to the Kassabs, and asked for help. Unfortunately, there are people who need those types of displays to believe in something. So I really wish my brother was a bullshit artist. If he was a bullshit artist, he would put on this big carnival affair of suffering and being a person who is completely wiped out. You see, everybody else imagines that they would be wiped out, and I'm sure he probably is inside. He just doesn't go into an orgy in front of a lot of people about it. He feels that he has to go on, and he has to live. And nobody can seem to accept the fact that a human being can go on and can struggle and keep on living. If people had a few carnival tears or a few carnival breakdowns, they might believe him. I really wish he was a bullshit artist. The Army clinical psychologist, who in August of 1970 had made his own analysis of the tests given to Jeffrey McDonald in Philadelphia in April, was called to testify. He spoke first of the opinions he'd formed from his review of McDonald's responses to the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, a test consisting of 566 true-false questions, ranging from, I like mechanics magazines, to, my father was a good man, and, at times, I see things that other people do not see. The test is designed to provide a general profile of an individual's overall personality adjustment. I think the first impression I had that was remarkable, the psychologist said, was that there was no indication from this particular test that there was any significant pathology existing. By that I mean, I was asked to evaluate whether there was any indication that the gentleman who filled out the exams was either psychotic or psychopathic. In going over this particular test, I found no indication to support either one of these diagnoses. Secondly, the data from this test was remarkable in what was not there, rather than what was. I found an absence of anxiety, an absence of depression, an absence of agitation, and I expected there to be some there. I expected there to be a high level of anxiety indicated, and what I found was low. Now, as part of this test, there are what we refer to as validity keys. We rely on them to give us an overall impression of the attitude with which a person took the examination that allows us roughly to say, yes, this is a valid test and we can use this data, or we should be cautious in using it because it may be invalid. I went ahead on the assumption that the material in the test was essentially valid. That was at that time. My experience in the intervening years would lead me to question that now. I now look at this test data on the MMPI, and I have a question in my mind as to its validity. My reservation is that the person who completed the questionnaire seems to have answered the questions in such a way as to present himself in the best light possible. That does not necessarily mean that he lied, but it at least indicates a certain awareness of the implications of some of the questions he was asked, and at least some attempt to present himself in the best light possible. That's why today I would want further examination. Typically, a person who has some awareness of himself, good points, bad points, or accepted and non-accepted characteristics in our society, and who wanted to present himself in the best light possible, would try to increase certain scores by answering questions in a positive way that would make him appear to be a very even-tempered, easygoing person, without any particular things bothering him. Now the data, as we get it to analyze it, is presented in graph form, and on the graph there are three lines. The middle line is considered to be average or normal. Anything below the lower line would be considered pathological, and anything above the upper line would be considered pathological. So a person without significant disturbances or conflicts his scores would range between the upper and lower lines. But a person also who is trying to present himself in a good light, and not everybody is able to, would also range his scores within these areas. And this is the pattern we have in this case. But the reason I have some question about it is that the degree of guardedness or caution that is shown in the validity keys that I mentioned before is significant enough to make me question it, to say, well, all right, is this valid? Should we take it just as we have it, or should we pursue it further? Without pursuing it further, there is no significant pathological condition indicated. However, on one scale here, it happens to be the scale which tends to be most sensitive to picking up feelings of anger and anxiety. It's almost not plottable on the graph, according to this individual's responses. That means there is almost a total absence of any score. That means he did not describe himself in any way as having any anger or agitation. And I find that remarkable. It may in fact be true, but I find it rather unusual. In fact, in my experience, this was the first time I had ever seen it. In the report I wrote back in 1970, I said, "The only explanation for this that I can offer is that the subject is able to muster massive denial or repression so that the impact of recent events in his life has been blunted." At that time, I had just been out of school a short time. I had academic training that was good and, I think, quite substantial. But since then, I've had a few years' time where I've had to start dealing with people, and that's different from what you learn in school. Your view changes. You start to see things that maybe you didn't see. And in this case, it jiggles my mind a little bit. It makes me a little cynical about accepting that particular test form just as it is. The second test about which the psychologist spoke was the thematic apperception test, in which the subject views a series of 19 pictures and one blank card and makes up a story about each. As described by its developer, Dr. Henry A. Murray of the Harvard Psychological Clinic, who devised the test in the early 1940s, the TAT is a method of revealing to the trained interpreter some of the dominant drives, emotions, sentiments, complexes, and conflicts of a personality. Special value resides in its power to expose the underlying inhibited tendencies, which the subject is not willing to admit or cannot admit because he is unconscious of them. If the pictures are presented as a test of imagination, the subject's interest, together with his need for approval, can be so involved in the task that he forgets his sensitive self and the necessity of defending it against the probings of the examiner, and before he knows it, he has said things about an invented character that apply to himself, things which he would have been reluctant to confess in response to a direct question. As a rule, the subject leaves the test happily unaware that he has presented the psychologist with what amounts to an X-ray picture of his inner self. In analyzing McDonald's TAT responses, the Walter Reed psychologist found evidence of several areas of inner conflict. One was dependence and independence, he said. Others were sexuality or lust and intimacy, affection and strength, hostility and love. It seemed to me that in all of these conflicts, there was a unifying theme, and that theme seemed to be power relationships. Who's in control? Who will control? Who will be controlled? Who has the influence? Who has the clout? The other thing that seemed to be of significance was that the subject's view of life was one in which events are thrust upon people and they have to react to them. From these stories that he created to go with the pictures, it didn't seem to be that an individual is one who goes out and so much creates his own way and makes life what he wants it to be. Rather, it seemed to be that events are happening and you have to deal with them. You have to overcome them or surmount them. It's a reaction kind of orientation, rather than an initiating kind of orientation. That in itself is not to be considered pathological. But that type of person might tend to see life as a series of problems which have to be overcome by himself, and therefore might be resentful and bitter. If it went to an extreme, this person would tend to see himself as victimized, perhaps, or perhaps somewhat of a martyr. This would put someone in a rather angry stance toward life, and again, that's why I was surprised to see so little anger reflected in other areas. I mentioned also in my 1970 report that the subject appears to be quite concerned with the issue of the definition of manliness and the related topics of appropriate behaviors for men and women. His analysis of MacDonald's Rorschach tests, the psychologist said, did not indicate either schizophrenic or psychopathic thought processes operating. Rather, the approach to situations that I picked up here was a mixture of both hysteroid and obsessive-compulsive features. By hysteroid, I mean the tendency to exaggerate the emotional component. For example, what a person who is not hysterical might feel as sorrow, a hysteroid person would experience as grief, and what a non-hysterical person would experience as an agitation in life, a hysterical or hysteroid type person would experience as a major trauma, a major problem to be dealt with. As to obsessive-compulsive features, I mean that the person is usually very, very careful to include in his thinking and in his planning all possible angles and all possible details of that particular situation, program, issue that he is dealing with. This type of person does not feel at ease saying, well, let's not worry about that. Everything needs to be worried about, and everything needs to be accounted for. And this type of person gets ill at ease when all things are not accounted for. Now, it's uncommon to have both of these characteristics presented by the same person, because typically we think of them as being opposing views. The hysterical type of person says, oh, what the heck, let's not worry about it at all. And the obsessive-compulsive type says, we've got to worry about every single detail. It is possible to have them both together, but when you do, usually the situation is that the person is under a great deal of stress, and his usual ways of handling situations are coming apart. Well, asked Victor Warheide, does that tend to indicate a pre-psychotic condition, an underlying paranoid condition? Yes. The status when this is present is usually pre-psychotic. Specifically, a paranoid psychosis would most likely develop quickly if the stressful situation were not alleviated in some way. What is a paranoid-type psychosis? Warheide asked. The paranoid-type psychosis takes one of two forms. In either case, the individual becomes convinced that his particular view of reality is absolutely the only correct view, and that anybody that disagrees with it is completely out of sync. The two forms it usually takes are either persecution or grandiosity. In the classical forms, the persecution type is where the person feels that everybody is out to get them, or kill them, or do them in. The grandiose type that you hear about most often is the person who believes he's Napoleon or Jesus Christ. These are the most dramatic forms, the extremes. There are all kinds of gradations in between. My feeling was with Captain MacDonald, if he were to become psychotic, it would probably be more of the grandiose type. Let me ask you this question, Victor Warheide said. Under a very stressful situation that might occur suddenly, could you have a psychotic phase of short duration and then, let's say, a return to the pre-psychotic condition? I believe so, yes. And let's say, with a paranoid phase of brief duration, would a person with a tendency toward the grandiose type of psychosis, a paranoid condition, be liable to commit an irrational act of violence? Well, that is possible. You use the term liable. I should have said possible. It is possible, yes. Being of that state of mind does not preclude violence. It makes it possible. But if I may comment on that, I don't think it's necessary to say that the person who committed these murders must have been either psychotic or psychopathic. I feel that's narrowing things too much. Please explain that. Well, it's possible for a person who normally lives a very well-contained and controlled life to reach a breaking point where he has an explosion of rage. Now, you expect some types of people to be prone to that more than others. The data that I was able to look at in this particular case lends itself to that possibility. I refer back now to what I said about hysteroid features and obsessive-compulsive features. The hysteroid features, if a person had those, first of all, he tends to overreact or dramatize situations. The obsessive-compulsive feature has one thing of particular interest to me, and that is that this type of person does not easily express anger. To my way of thinking, that's the main issue. This type of person would not usually exhibit anger by pounding his fist or something like that. He would not be threatening people, but he would still be angry. Now, this hypothetical type of person would be likely to do a long, slow burn, but at some particular point, that anger may just come out. Something triggers an explosion? Yes. And you might then, with this type of person, you might then think about rage, if you could distinguish rage from anger. You might expect this person to be full of rage at some point. All right, Warheide said. Now, with respect to this person to whom these documents relate, can you think of some incident, occurrence, event, statement, some challenge that might trigger this explosion? Well, it seems likely to me that one of the main themes or values in this person's life could be called manliness. It might be referred to as sexuality, but I think sexuality is a little too narrow. I would call it manliness, which would include sexual behavior, but would include more things too, like status, power, influence, rank, prestige. It seems to me that if this person were to be seriously challenged in terms of his own concept of who he is and how other people see him, he is most vulnerable in this area of manliness. And that if he were pushed in this area, if he's going to explode, that's most likely, I think, where he would explode. Let's say if a woman, his wife, and he have a quarrel, and she said, "Oh, you're not a man," or something more specific. Could that do it? Warheide asked. If your question is, could that bring out a rage? I think yes. And could it bring out a rage that might be characterized as a temporary paranoid psychosis? Well, I don't know, because that is an academic question, and you have many, many disagreements about that. All right, let's put it in layman's terms. Under the circumstances that I have outlined, is the subject capable of a violent outburst? I think so. Which he might very well regret a few minutes later? Yes, yes, I think this type of person might be swept up in a rage. Well, let's say he had just killed his wife. Do you think he would go so far as to kill his children to cover up the fact that he killed his wife? Do you think he could go to an extreme like that in a rage? I could only speculate about it, but I can imagine that a person like this might commit murder at a point of rage, and the rage might not be over in a period of just a minute. The rage may last for some time. If that occurs, then I'd say that maybe this is possible. The whole thing could basically be accomplished in, let's say, 2 or 3 minutes, Victor Warheide said. There's no problem about a period of rage extending that long, I take it. No, I don't think so. Also, whether subsequent people, like the children in this case, would be murdered at the point of rage, I don't know. But I can imagine that the fear at that point might have been an overwhelming, extraordinary fear. Now, in regard to this particular case, Warheide asked, and the paranoid-type psychosis, might this be expressed by, say, in regard to the MPs who came to the house and found an emergency situation, the CID agents who conducted the investigation, the medics who came and gave first aid, the hospital personnel who treated him, taking the attitude, they're all bunglers, they're idiots, they're stupid, they are jerks, they didn't do things right, they're incompetent. Yes, it could be conveyed that way. Also, in reviewing the informal psychological data, that is, how did the subject relate to the examiner and to the testing situation, I might say that I felt there were several instances where I had to question, is this man's reality testing amiss somehow? Is there some psychotic process operating here? Because his behavior was quite inappropriate, given the data I had. And even if some of the comments and the asides that the subject made during the examination were explained away, and therefore did not look psychotic or paranoid, there still remains an attitude conveyed by the subject which I would call paranoid-like. It is the conveying of a contempt, of a disparagement towards the examination, towards the examiner, towards the whole process that was going on at that time. In my experience, I have found that to occur usually with people who have a long-standing paranoid orientation toward life. Either they feel they're being done in or persecuted a lot, or they feel that they are someone very special and have maybe special privileges and this sort of thing. More the grandiose type. I call it paranoid-like because I had not enough data nor opportunity to pursue that further. But to me, that's a legitimate question. A grand juror then asked a question. Does every individual have a certain amount of paranoia? No, the psychologist said. I disagree with that. There is a school of thought within psychology and psychiatry that would hold that everyone has a little bit of everything in them. But I don't hold to that myself. I think that really makes our discipline somewhat ridiculous. Because to me, it's on the order of saying, well, everything in the world is a shade of yellow. But if you're not yellow, that just means you're a different variety of yellow. I don't find that appealing at all. Then I conclude, the grand juror asked, that everyone does not possess that point of rage which would push them into an act of brutal violence. Some people do not possess that point. Well, I think theoretically it is possible to say that any one of us could become enraged. But practically speaking, there are people that I'm sure all of us have known who never exhibit rage, and not necessarily because it's suppressed. It's that their worldview is different, and so they don't get into that sort of thing. My feeling is that you cannot substantiate the idea that we all are this way, and the circumstances simply haven't occurred to us. The psychologist was then asked, as had been the other witnesses, if he had any further comments to make. Well, he said, it is a little bit outside my area of training to answer the question of whether or not this person committed murder, but I do feel it within my area to say that it is possible that this person could have a rage reaction and might have become violent at that time. I think it is possible. And when I first wrote my report 4 years ago, I took care to state that I could not assess the probability of the subjects having committed murder. I have acquired some experience since 1970, which makes me change my opinion. I would now put more emphasis on the likelihood that it could happen. Jeffrey McDonald's mother came to Raleigh to testify. Mr. Warheide, she said, in our family we had three children, two boys and a girl, and it was a strongly masculine-oriented family. Jay, being the firstborn, was kind of a special person, naturally, to his father, and there was some sibling competitiveness in terms of Jay being the one who was reasonably successful in the early years. Jeff would, in a sense, emulate him. Like, if one played football, then the other one became interested in playing football. They were like three-sport men in high school. They were both good. Jay happened to win an award as the All-Suffolk Lineman of the Year. Jeff was the quarterback on his team. Now, with Jay, there was some difficulty when he reached junior high school. He would have highs and lows, like he would work hard and get good marks, and then he would go into a slump. And I would be called in and they would suggest that he was goofing off a little bit. When he left high school, because my husband's background, you see, he was an engineer at the Brookhaven National Labs, but he was a man who was slightly upset about the fact that although he is classified as an engineer, he was not a four-year college graduate. And one of the things that troubled him was that although he was capable and respected by everybody and his judgment was used frequently, and he was always considered a top-notch man, still, essentially, among the college people, He was not valued as high in his salary, monetarily, and as a result, he felt it was very important for his children to receive college educations, and so it was in our minds that Jay would go to college. I realize now in looking back that one should really sit down and explore with the person whether or not that is what they wish to do. However, he really posed no objection, and he was accepted at three colleges, and he visited one and liked it very well. I believe it was the University of Virginia, and he visited another and didn't like it as much, but his father insisted that he take the northern choice rather than the southern. With all due respect to the South, my husband just felt that the northern education was something more akin to his background, and so he went to St. Lawrence University in northern New York State. "But he never finished college?" Warheide asked. "Excuse me, sir. You see, he really did. Only it was like a hard way round. You see, St. Lawrence was ready to have him stay out for 6 months after his first semester because he took a girl after a prom back to Canada, and then he came back and used very bad judgment again by speeding, being picked up, and because he was a St. Lawrence student, it was reported to the college, and because they had had three cases of similar nature, they sat in kind of harsh judgment on him, perhaps. We got the notice that he was being held out of college for 6 months. Now, I, as a parent, and my husband, Mac, felt that if we let him not go to college for 6 months, that he might not continue. And because of that feeling in the family that he was capable, we thought we might try more locally. And Jay seemed very satisfied with the idea of going to a college on Long Island where he could come home nights. And he did finish college at Adelphi, by essentially going nights, days, working in between, and always financially trying to help so that everybody could support their own weight, along with what we as parents were contributing. As a personality, Jay looked like a leader, and somehow because of the size of him and the quality of magnetism that he had, people assumed him to be one, when in fact he tended to take on coloration from whoever he was with. Like, for instance, the time that both kids worked as taxi drivers. My kids really put forth a great deal of effort, whether they were taxi drivers, construction men, supervisors of construction. Jay went on to become a $1 million-a-year salesman in insurance after he had graduated from college, but it seemed to me that in everything he did, his judgment wasn't too sound. In order to prove himself, he was spending more than he was literally earning, and it got to a point where he really was heavily in debt, but I was not cognizant of that until I guess it was too late. He was on drugs? Well, he had come into college in his freshman year at 175 pounds, and by the time he had finished, at the end of the first year, he was close to his present weight of about 240. So I should have recognized that the signs of distress were there. That kind of ingestion of either alcohol or food to that extent in that short period of time, I recognize as sort of an oral need for support, and I should have perhaps been more alert. At any rate, in order to reduce, because he was a big man with a big appetite and loved big parties and did everything in a large and grand style, which was very much like my husband's attitude, like, open the house, everyone is welcome. He probably tended to take on that aspect of my husband, and he began, apparently, to take pills to reduce, to curb his appetite. I learned later from Jeff and Judy, both, that he was probably taking much too much dexedrine, and that they were both aware of it, and they had worked with him verbally and tried to warn him that it would have devastating effects, but they really were not telling me because they felt that I would be upset. This was right before he went down into the village and became a bartender. He was a salesman and working with these men and so forth on the big construction jobs, and I had the feeling then that he was living beyond his means. But he was always overwhelmed by the idea of, like, owning a Cadillac, things of that nature. He was a little grandiose in his dreams. But of course you must realize also that when he started working on the beach, on Fire Island, that became part of his life. He really enjoyed the beach, and as a result, each year the reason why his jobs never seemed to last too long was that he was perfectly willing and able to work, say, from September through May, but the minute it was summertime, for some reason, that terminated his employment. And you could see the pattern, and we would all say to him, "Jay, you really ought to think seriously about this, and he would say, "This is my way, and I like the beach, and I can make do at the beach." So he would rent this large house, and then rent parts of it to the groupies, who were people who came in and took a